Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel. You're listening to The Jewish Truth Bomb with Lenny Goldberg.
Hi, this is Lenny Goldberg, and thanks for joining me today. Today is Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the first of the month of Nisan. It's the month of Passover. It's the month of the Geula, of the redemption. And I'm sitting here holding the Haggadah of the Jewish idea in my hand. Some of you have already ordered them. I sent them out as fast as I could. Hope it gets there before Pesach. And I want to talk about the cover of the book, the jacket. When I sent out the Haggadah to those who ordered it, I sent them out without the jackets, without the book jackets, because I couldn't find them. And one of the reasons they got lost is because we were always being hounded by the authorities and things got misplaced and moved. It's like the Jew in the exile from all his wanderings and trials and tribulations. We lost a lot of our books. Well, we lost the Haggadah for a long time. Couldn't find it. And when we did find it, I couldn't find the jackets of the books. I knew we had them, but I wasn't going to go crazy looking for them. But after I sent out the first 10 Haggadahs or so, I found the jackets. It was a miracle. And on these book jackets, I realized that they are very important because they explain the pictures on the cover of the Haggadah. You see, this Haggadah of the Jewish idea with commentary by Binyamin Zev Kahana, it's got a bunch of pictures on the cover where you might say, well, what does this have to do with the holiday of Passover? You have on the top Baruch Goldstein, you have Shlomo ben Yosef, Rabbi Aryeh Levin, Yaya Stern, a symbol of Yosef Trumpeldor. You have a picture of the King David Hotel in rubbles after the Etzel bombed it, and other pictures of Jewish heroes or Jewish heroism. So what does that have to do with Passover? Why is Baruch Goldstein on the cover? Are we just trying to be provocative? No. These are pictures of people and objects that symbolize Misirut Nefesh, self-sacrifice. And self-sacrifice, that's the key to bringing the redemption. And now I'm going to read off the book jacket because it's so important and so vital to the Geula in Egypt and the future redemption. And this is what it says on the jacket of the cover, which explains the pictures that I mentioned. We have a verse in the Haggadah, a verse that's taken from the book of Ezekiel. B'damaych chayi, b'damaych chayi. It says twice, through your blood shall you live. And the second time, through your blood shall you live. What does that mean, through your blood, that's how you live? The Midrash explains it. The time came for God to fulfill his vow to Abraham and redeem his sons. But there were no commandments for them to fill that they may merit redemption. That is, the Jewish people in Egypt were on such a low level, we didn't have any mitzvahs to make us worthy of redemption. So it says like this. So God gave them two commandments. The blood of the Passover sacrifice and the blood of the circumcision so that they may fulfill these commandments and merit redemption. And so that's why it says through your blood shall you live. The Jews, in order to be worthy of redemption, they had to exhibit self-sacrifice. They had to spill some blood. What blood was that? It was the blood of the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb. They took the deity of the Egyptians and slaughtered it and cooked it and wipe the blood of the Korban Pesach on their doorpost. That's blood of self-sacrifice because it was a scary thing to slaughter the lamb, which was the deity of your master, before his eyes to provoke him, to tie his deity to your bedpost for 4 days, and then you roast it before his eyes. So that's one type of blood. And the other blood mentioned is the blood of the circumcision. The Jews performed the circumcision, the Brit Milah in Egypt. And that, of course, represents Misirut Nefesh and self-sacrifice because you're spilling blood. An 8-year-old baby cutting his foreskin? Ouch! Misirut Nefesh. And so that's why it says, B'damai chayi, twice, through your blood shall you live. Those two commandments that involved blood, that made us worthy. That made us worthy of the redemption. And so that's the rule. Without self-sacrifice, without spilling blood, nothing's going to happen. And now I'll read the next sentence on the jacket explaining, B'damai chayi, through your blood shall you live. Why is it written twice? So we said it's written twice because you have two types of bloodshedding, the circumcision and the Korban Pesach. But there's another reason it's written twice. To teach us, just as we were redeemed in Egypt through self-sacrifice, so too will our final redemption come through the merit of self-sacrifice. And therefore, the words, through your blood shall you live, is written twice. And so, of course, it really has to be that way. How could anything great be achieved without self-sacrifice? Not just in Jewish history, in any history. You look at the history of the American Revolution. There's a lot of self-sacrifice involved. Mesirut Nefesh. Mesirut Nefesh literally means to send your soul, to deliver your soul. Now, not every self-sacrifice has to be dying for something, but yeah, that is the ultimate sacrifice. But it doesn't have to be through dying, but it's through trying. Self-sacrifice comes in a lot of forms, and you can't achieve anything without it. You know, there's a great song by Zev Jabotinsky called Rosh Pina. It's a song about Shlomo ben Yosef, one of the members of the Jewish underground who was hung by the British. He was the first one to be hung. And his picture is on the Haggadah, by the way. And there's a short explanation of what he was all about in the Haggadah. But going back to Zev Jabotinsky's song, Rosh Pina, one of the verses in the song go like this. Ein kov shimet rosh ha-sela, you can't conquer the top of the mountain, im ein kever ba-morad, if there's no grave on the slope. And so that's so basic. If we want to make something happen, we got to give of ourselves. It's not going to be enough for us to vote for some politician on election day and expect him to, you know, somehow bring the redemption. It just doesn't work that way. It's not enough to make great podcasts and write great books. Because, you know, it's nice to throw out all kinds of ideas. Everybody's conveying all these beautiful ideas on Passover and Purim and the Parsha. Lots of nice ideas, but you can't give ideas all day. You have to eventually actualize those ideas. And if you don't, it just remains air. Without the self-sacrifice of applying these ideas, then it's all meaningless. And so self-sacrifice, Mesirut Nefesh, that's the key to anybody's personal redemption, to a national redemption. It's the key to anything if you want to achieve something great. And it's a rare commodity today because we've all grown kind of fat and materialistic. And there's just not a lot of Mesirut Nefesh going around. There's a lot of Pikuach Nefesh going around. Everybody's trying to save a soul and trying to be safe. Pikuach Nefesh. You don't have that Mesirut Nefesh. You don't have the self-sacrifice. And I want to read something in Tractate Brachot where the rabbis lament the lack of Mesirut Nefesh in their days. And this is what it says. Rav Papa asked Abaye, why is it that miracles were performed for the earlier generations while miracles are not performed for us? So Rav Papa and Abaye, two important rabbis in the Gemara, they're living in a time of a lot of tzaddikim, but they're saying, but in our generation, we don't get the miracles like in earlier generations. So they're trying to figure out why not. And so they discuss it. If you say that the reason is because they studied a great deal of Torah, that cannot be so. Because in the days of Rav Yehuda, that is the early generation, Rav Yehuda, all their learning was concentrated in one part of the Mishnah, in the Zikin. Well, we study all six parts. So we learn a lot more Torah than them. They only had one tractate to learn. We learned the entire Shas, the whole Talmud. And nevertheless, God performed miracles in their generation and not in our generation. They give an example. At a time of drought in the days of Rabbi Yehuda, in the early generations, all he had to do to pray for rain, he would just take off his shoe and the rain would come down. He would just remove his shoe, which was like a sign of mourning, a preparation before he prays. Before he even started praying, it started to rain. We, on the other hand, we suffer and we cry out and we wail to the heavens and we are not listened to. And so Abaye, the same one who asked the question, he answers the question. He says like this, the earlier generations were prepared to sacrifice themselves, l'kadeshim shamayim, to sanctify God's name. Well, we are not prepared to sacrifice ourselves to sanctify his great name. And so there you have it in black and white in the Talmud, that because the rabbis in the earlier generations had self-sacrifice and Mesirut Nefesh, God granted them miracles, even though they learned a lot less than the rabbis in the later generations. So that's what counts, how much you're willing to give for the cause. And so that's the key to redemption, and you can never underestimate the power of Mesirut Nefesh. You know, just an example, when Rabbi Kahane used to give a shiur, let's say it was a class on King David or Moses or one of the Jewish heroes, I could hear the same class, maybe almost word for word, maybe from another rabbi. But because I knew Rabbi Kahane really walked the walk, what he's been through already, that when he reads it and when he teaches it, it's coming from a source that lives it. It's just much more impactful when he would give the same shiur because you know who's giving it. You know who's standing behind it. It's not just an idea in the air. It's somebody who walked the walk. I want to speak about two Jewish heroes who really walked the walk. One of them was Meir Feinstein, and the other was Moshe Berezani, who both died in April of 1947, exactly 77 years ago. These were young men from the Jewish undergrounds who were fighting the British in the Holy Land during those pre-state days. In 1944, when the Holocaust was in full swing, Meir Feinstein was 15 years old. He was in Israel at the time, and he decided to fight the Nazis by joining the British Army. He was young, but he looked a lot older, and he eventually got to fight. And during his military service, he met other soldiers who were, of course, secretly members of the Irgun, and he helped them smuggle weapons and ammunition for the underground. So naturally, when Meir Feinstein was discharged from the army in April of 1946, he joined the Irgun. And because he had military training in the British Army, he was assigned to the Irgun Combat Force. Okay, now, in the Irgun's fight against the British rule, they liked to attack British infrastructure. And they went on these daring missions to free prisoners, like the breakout of Akko Jail. They were good at confiscating British weapons for the use of the underground. The operations of the Irgun were intended to convince the British military and the British public opinion that they should leave Eretz Israel. Okay, so what happened to Meir Feinstein was he was caught in an attack on a Jerusalem train station. After blowing it up, he and eight other Irgun fighters, they rushed into a getaway car in hasty retreat from the British authorities who were chasing them down. And Meir Feinstein was driving the car. And while he was driving, the British were shooting at the car, and Meir's hand was severely hit by a clip of bullets. But he continued driving the car. And as he drove, he calmly told his friends, "Hey, I'm driving with only one hand." And at first, his friends thought that he was just joking around. He's driving with one hand. But they realized that Meir's left hand was severely decimated by the bullets. So he really was driving with one hand. Okay, so Meir Feinstein appears in court without a lawyer. And when the British officers read the charges and they ask Meir how he would plead, Meir said, "I do not recognize the legality of this trial. I will not participate in the proceedings." And he would repeatedly tell his family and his fiance that, and I quote, "It is better to die with dignity than to live in humiliation." So he didn't participate in the trial at all. He read newspapers and Jabotinsky's books during the trial. And before the reading of the verdict against him, he gave the following speech. I'm just going to give excerpts from it. He says like this. He says, "British officers, in your foolish wickedness, you presume that your regime is going to break our people's spirit, the people to whom this whole country has been a gallows. You're wrong. You will learn that you have encountered steel forged in the fire of love and hatred. Love for the homeland and freedom, hatred for enslavement and invaders. Yes, it's burning steel, and you are not going to break it. How blind you are, British tyrants. Don't you realize who you're going up against? You think you can scare us with death? We, who have heard the rattling of the wheels of those railroad cars, who led our brothers, our parents, the best of our nation to slaughter, which has no precedent in human history? We, who ask ourselves every day, in what way are we better than them from the millions of our brothers? We could have been one of them, for we could have been among them and with them in the days of fear and in the moments of dying. And to these recurring questions, there is in our conscience but one answer. We remained alive, not to live in conditions of slavery and oppression. Another Treblinka, we remained alive to ensure life, freedom, and dignity for us, for our nation, for our children and their children, for generations to come. And therefore, we're not going to be frightened, for we have learned that there is a life worse than death, and there is death greater than life. And if you have not understood by now the specter of this Jewish nation, a nation that has nothing to lose except her bondage of slavery, it's a sign that you have been blinded. And so you will be removed from the stage from which God removes all those who stand up to the eternal people in order to destroy it. Assyria and Babylon and ancient Greece and the Roman Empire, Spain and Germany preceded you, but you will follow their lead. That is the divine rule." Okay, that was Meir Feinstein's speech, at the court, and the underground guys did that a lot. They used the court proceedings as a platform to bring over their ideology. Okay, so he's put on death row in the Jerusalem Central Prison, and he's put in a cell with another underground fighter named Moshe Barazani. Now, Barazani was a Lehi guy. He was from the Stern Gang, and he was on a mission to assassinate a senior British officer, Brigadier A.P. Davies. He was on his way to knock him off, and he had a grenade in his pocket. By the way, the Lehi, unlike the Etzel, were really into assassinating high-ranking British officers. Anyway, Barazani was stopped and searched in Jerusalem. They found the grenade in his pocket. He was arrested for that. And now he and Mayor Feinstein, they're put in the same cell. And they became close friends. They're on death row now. And when Moshe Barazani was sitting in jail, his father came to him for the last time on the Shabbat before his death. And he tried to convince his son to ask for a pardon. But Moshe told him, "Father, you're a religious Jew who believes in the next world. So why are you so sorry for me? I am only one drop in the sea of 6 million brothers and sisters who perished in the Holocaust. I'm just a sacrifice for our people and our land. Our blood is not going to waste, because from it, the people of Israel will be resurrected." Okay, I haven't gotten to the best part yet. Listen to what happened to them. So they're waiting in their prison cell, waiting to be hung. Now, the undergrounds were plotting for some time what they called Operation Samson, a Samson-like attack for the condemned men. The idea was this. What happened to Samson, the biblical judge? Well, when he died, he took the Philistines down with him, right? He pushed the pillars and brought down the entire temple, killing himself and all those in the temple with him. That's what it says in the book of Judges, that the dead which he slew at his death were more than which he slew in his life. And so they're naming this plan Operation Samson. The idea again, that if we're going to die, let's take out some British soldiers with us, just like Samson took lots of Philistines down with him. And Mayor Feinstein and Moshe Barazani readily accepted the plan, the Samson plan. Now, tachlis, how is this plan going to work? Well, the plan is to smuggle in explosives so they can kill themselves together with their British executioners in their final moment of life before they're hung. Because the custom in all British executions in Palestine was that the commander of the prison and other high-ranking officials, they would attend the execution, and that would provide prime targets for the plan. So Mayor Feinstein and Moshe Barazani, they're glad to use their death as a way of inflicting some damage on the enemy. The problem is, how do you smuggle explosives into the jail? So the first thought was to use tefillin, you know, the tefillin boxes, as a container for the grenades, because tefillin is a religious object and it's easy to transfer to the prison. But it became clear that the tefillin boxes were too small for any meaningful explosion. So they decided to use oranges for the mission. You cut up an orange, cut off the top, remove its contents, and you put a grenade inside. And then you stick the peel back on. And then you have to make sure that that orange makes its way into the cell. Okay, so in April 1947, like I said, 77 years ago to this date, the rumors started to circulate that they're going to hang Feinstein and Barazani. And the protocol was that a rabbi visits them on the day of the execution to perform the vidui, the confession prayer. Now, Rabbi Ari Levine, who we've talked about on this podcast, he was usually the one called to do it, to do the vidui with the prisoners. But he was so heartbroken for failing to save them. He had tried to save them. He was so heartbroken that he said, "I can't go. And besides, what's their sin? What crime do they need to confess to? There are no bigger tzaddikim. There's no bigger saints than these two youngsters who are going to the gallows on Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name. So they don't need a confession." Anyway, it was Mishamayim. Somehow God orchestrated it that way, because this was the only time that Rabbi Ari Levine, who was called the father of the prisoners, refused to come to the central prison of Jerusalem. So they got another rabbi, the official rabbi of the Jewish National Council. His name was Rabbi Yaakov Goldman, and he agreed to come to see them so they could do vidui, confess, and all that. But the thing is, the rabbi announced that he would be present at the execution because he wanted the boys to see, and I quote, "the face of a loving brother and not the face of an enemy," before they died. Okay, so if the rabbi is going to be with them up to the execution, that eliminates their great Samson plan. because they don't want to harm the rabbi who would be standing with the executioners. Now, of course, they could not reveal what they wanted to do to this rabbi. He might, you know, turn him in. He'd talk him out of it. They couldn't tell him in any case. So they did their best to convince the rabbi to go home, but it didn't work. The rabbi insisted to stay. So what do? They sang HaTikvah. The rabbi went to another room in the prison, expecting to return at 4 a.m. for the execution. And he left them a few matches to enjoy their remaining cigarettes. So what could they do now? They gave up the idea of dying with the Philistines. So hours before the execution, at 11:40 p.m. on April 21st, they clasped each other in a last brotherly embrace, Meir Feinstein and Moshe Berezani, one Ashkenazi, one Sephardi, one from the Etzel, the other from the Lehi, and they placed the grenade between their hearts and lit the fuse with their last cigarettes. And the tremendous boom was heard in the Russian compound. And of course, it made huge news. And because they did what they did, it came to pass that during the entire Jewish revolt against the British to free Eretz Israel, not a single Jew was hung in the gallows of the holy city of Jerusalem because of this. They were all hung in Akko. They tried to set a precedent by hanging Berezani and Feinstein in Jerusalem, but after this happened, they didn't try anymore. And you know, today, if you visit the Russian compound in Jerusalem, which still functions as a police station, you'll find that the former prison has been transformed into a museum. And visitors can witness the cell where Feinstein and Berezani ended their lives with that grenade. And remarkably, you can still see the marks on the jail walls left by the pieces of the grenade. And so that's just an example of many of how it was only huge self-sacrifice which chased the British out of Palestine. And it was only in the merit of Misru Nefesh that we got a Jewish state in the first place. It wasn't because of diplomacy and the Balfour Declaration or a UN vote. And to continue on the path of redemption, we're going to need a lot of Misru Nefesh, a lot of self-sacrifice like that. But getting back to England and the British rule in Israel during those pre-state days, if you read the book by Begin, The Revolt, the way they tortured Jews in this country, the way they blocked the shores so Jews could not escape Europe during the Holocaust. Why do I mention this? Because just this past week, the Foreign Secretary of England, Cameron, Lord Cameron, he threatened Israel with a European-wide arms embargo. Why? Unless Israel allows the United Nations access to the Hamas prisoners, then he's threatening a boycott. So yeah, this same country, England, who really were part and parcel to the Holocaust, they cooperated with Hitler when it came to the extermination of the Jews, blocking the shores of Palestine, the white paper, unbelievable chutzpah. And that's the thing about these arrogant British, you know what, they never apologized for anything for what they did. They remained anti-Semitic with their BBC reporting, taking sides with the Arabs every time. So when this Lord Cameron threatens Israel, why don't we bring up the history of how the British conducted themselves in this country? How they left all their arms for the Arabs when they left the country so the Arabs could finish off what Hitler started? That is the record of the British Empire. And they're not even an empire anymore anyway. They're infested with Muslims and they're going down too, part of their divine punishment. And that's why one of my favorite pictures on the Haggadah of the Jewish idea is a picture of the King David Hotel in rubbles after Begin and the Etzel blew it up. They killed a whole bunch of Englishmen. And that was one of the final straws that broke the back of British rule here. Because at that point, they were just saying, it's just not worth it for us to have to allocate so many soldiers to this one country. Moving on to something totally different. This past Shabbat, we read Parshat Shmini, and towards the end of the reading, we learn all about what animals are considered kosher and which aren't kosher. So for an animal to be kosher, he has to have the following characteristics. He has to have split hooves, and he has to chew his cud. That is, after swallowing it, he regurgitates it once again. Those are the two simanim, signs of kashrut, that you know it's a kosher animal. And then later in the Torah, it lists 10 kosher animals, the ox, the sheep, the goat, etc. And then in our parsha that we just read, the Torah warns us not to eat animals which, even though they have one of the characteristics, they lack the second. And there are only four such animals that have one sign of being kosher, but they're not kosher because they don't have the second sign. And they are the camel, who chews its cud, but it doesn't have split hooves, so it's not kosher. And the rabbit also doesn't have split hooves. The hare also has no hooves. And finally, the pig, which does have split hooves, but it doesn't chew its cud. Okay, so that's real nice. Now, we know that the Torah is deep, and you can go several layers deeper into anything. And the sages in Midrash Rabbah explain that these last four animals that I mentioned with one kosher sign, each one represents a different empire. First of all, the camel. The camel represents Babylon. Why? Because King David wrote in Tehillim about Babylon, "Praiseworthy is he who takes vengeance on you for what you did to us." And the word to repay you, to do what you did to us, in Hebrew, the word is gmul. And the Hebrew word for camel is gamal. So that sounds a lot like gmul. And that's the connection to Babylon. The next animal, the shafan, the rabbit, that represents the Persian Empire. Why? Because like we said, the rabbit has one kosher sign and another sign that isn't kosher. And that represents the Persian Empire because sometimes they have good leaders and sometimes they're bad. For instance, Cyrus, the king of Persia, was really good. But you also had Daryavish and Ahasuerus, who were really bad. Or in modern times, you can say you had the Shah, who was good, and the Ayatollah is bad. That's why the Shafan, the rabbit, represents Persia. Then you have the hare. So in Hebrew, the word for hare is Arnevit, and that represents the Greek Empire. Because when the rabbis had to translate the Torah into Greek, they didn't want to mention the word Arnevit, because the king at the time, Talmai, his wife's name was Arnevit. And when the rabbis were translating the Torah, they didn't want to write Arnevit because it's a non-kosher animal. It would be insulting. So they changed it. And that's why the Arnevit represents Greece. And finally, who is the pig? The pig is Edom, which is the Roman Empire. And it's mentioned last, and also it has its own verse, because Edom, they are the final and the most brutal empire. And the pig is the only animal of those four which has the kosher sign of a cleft hoof. He has that sign, but he doesn't chew its cud. So it's the opposite of the others, who chew their cud but don't have cleft hooves. And so what's different about the pig is you think he's kosher. He's showing you his hooves. He's saying, look, I'm kosher. But he isn't, because he doesn't chew his cud, and that's harder to notice. And again, only the pig has that characteristic. And that shows the hypocrisy of Edom, of Rome, of the West. They act like they're a friend, but as they smile, they put the screws to you. So Edom and Rome is also representative of the church. They preach love, turn the other cheek, but they've killed more Jews in the name of the church than anybody else. And today as well, we see the hypocrisy of the pig, of the Biden administration, pressuring Israel into suicidal concessions while we're fighting a two-front war. And so we just have to say no to that pig. That's it for me. Next week, we'll have a special Passover podcast from the Haggadah of the Jewish Idea. Those who haven't ordered it, we have it in English, Hebrew, and French. Mail me at lennygoldberg40@gmail.com. If you want to order, don't forget also to listen to my Bible classes, Lenny Goldberg's Bible classes. It's a podcast you can hear on Spotify or other platforms. There's nothing like the Tanakh, getting down to the basics. And I'll be back next week, same time, same station.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.